Welcome to today's segment of our Briefly Focused series, Maximizing Productivity While Minimizing Distractions. I'm Belinda McCauley, Executive Director of the Beverly Hills Bar Association. I'm delighted to introduce today's speaker, Sina Block. Sina is on a mission to help high-performing professionals and entrepreneurs with ADHD who struggle to manage it all, align, and live productively. She's a certified ADHD coach, business consultant, author, and master facilitator. She is the founder and CEO of SaneSpaces.com and creator of the Time and Space Style Inventory, the first online productivity assessment. Her clients find crystal clear focus and tether to what matters to them most. Overwhelm disappears as clients learn about the neuroscience behind motivation, behavior, and emotional set points. Clients go inward to build neuroplasticity and regain control of their time, priorities, and boundaries. This helps them develop hybrid systems, habits, and routines to support their bullet train brains. Her clients get organized and more productive. We are very happy that she's going to share much of that wisdom with us today. So with that, Sina, it's all yours.
Thanks, Belinda. I'm going to try to do my share situation here and make sure that we're on point. Can you just confirm for me that we're good?
All good.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us today. We have a lot to cover, so I don't want to take any more time than we need to. But the goal, the ask today was to create some productivity strategies, but also manage some ideas about staying organized. So what I'm going to ask you is to enter this webinar with some thoughts in mind about personalized strategies for yourself. You can cherry pick from the many number of things that we're going to go through today and focus on those areas where it would be helpful for you to improve your concentration and maximize your time. So we will look at different ways to do that, from managing your energy to improving concentration to really starting with physical and digital clutter. We're going to cover some time management strategies, as well as help you leave this session with some ideas of your own personal productivity changes that you need to make to work smarter, not harder. So without further ado, let's start with our outline. Let's see if this is going to move. Okay. So we're going to break this into two segments. The first segment is going to be strategies for clutter and organization. And then the second, the longer strategy is really going to be, or the segment is going to be about productivity strategies. And so with regard to clutter and organization, we'll do a little review on executive function. If you would like to attend the session that I gave last week, it's about boundaries, and there's a lot in there on executive function and setting boundaries for yourself. So we're just going to do a scratch the surface review about what executive function is and how it is compromised when it comes to an ADHD brain. We're going to look a little bit on why people keep things and why people hold on to things that turn into clutter. We're going to address physical and digital clutter and then look how productivity and clutter are related. And then the second segment of our session today is really going to focus on productivity. And it's a huge topic. So I'm going to give you kind of a splatter paint approach to a bunch of different strategies for you to pick up on. And we're going to look at energy management, deep work, this idea of deep work from Cal Newport. We're going to look at interruptions, focusing in on rules and rituals and redundancies, and hopefully you'll pick up some tips for your own strategies of productivity. Okay, so without further ado, remember, executive functioning skills are at play here all the time, especially if you have ADHD. And executive functioning skills, we think about them as the conductor of an orchestra. They're a wide range of central control processes in your brain, and they help you to do a lot of things. Inhibit, connect, prioritize and integrate your cognitive functions moment by moment. Your brain is running a million different algorithms at any time and really creating predictability for different conditions. And so executive function includes all of these areas. And when you have ADHD, you have impaired executive function. So it's the executive function is the part of your brain that filters through all incoming information. It decides what's important. It files away things that you can focus on. It helps you focus on a task at hand, engage in conversation, or do things like move or adjust or exercise or take action. So with ADHD, either executive function is highly impaired, or functions under certain conditions or limited conditions. And instead of being able to turn on and off easily, it's often very compromised between all of these different areas. So studies show that people with ADHD are physically wired different than those without it. And often you'll see studies that the brain might develop slower. There may be an even 5% size difference between an ADHD brain and a neurotypical brain. But often what we notice is basically how it presents. And it presents in these executive functioning abilities to see where the rubber meets the road. So ADHD impacts what you choose to focus on, deciding when to focus, how you plan things out, how to stay on task, and how to move and think differently. Those are kind of the biggest buckets. So how does this impact people with ADHD? Well, we look at studies to say that there's an average loss of 22 days of productivity per year. It's about almost up to 2 days, working days per year that ADHD people struggle with. ADHD drives employment challenges. Nearly 60% of ADHD adults are more likely to be fired, and 30% are more likely to face ongoing employment challenges. The sources are here in links. ADHD makes distraction and focus very difficult. Approximately 59% of employees with ADHD report being easily distracted or sidetracked, and 56% struggle to maintain focus and engagement. And there is an extraordinarily higher development of burnout due to executive functioning deficits. So, burnout is what we're always trying to avoid. But I work with a lot of people who are especially attorneys with ADHD who are really struggling in that area because of their unsupported work and things that are very, very difficult. So how does clutter connect to all this executive functioning? Well, a couple of different ways. Barbara Hemphill, who's one of the grandmothers of the professional organizing industry, says that clutter is simply postponed decisions, that things stay in our area of view because we have not decided what to do with them. There was a study published in the Journal of Environmental Psychology, which defines clutter as an overabundance of possessions that collectively create chaotic and disorderly living spaces. So it talks about this particular quote, talks about this subjective experience, but it's really focused on living versus working. Of course, clutter can impact how we work as well. So in contrast, my definition that I used to use when I would work with people in a professional organizing capacity in the first rendition of Sane Spaces before I became a coach, was this was our definition that we would start with in any organizing project. And that was organize equals knowing what you have, having what you need, and knowing where to find it when you need it. As opposed to just being neat, which pertains to kind of aesthetic arrangements of things and other things. So the idea of being organized enough is really about having functional spaces and having things accessible. And it can vary among individuals and be very specific to your individual tastes. So, take a look around your environment now, your work environment now, And we have a poll to start today, and it's our clutter poll. So if you can put this up for me, Susie, appreciate it. Yeah, so here's the poll. I'm going to move it over. How does clutter impact your life? Are you really organized? Clutter is not a problem. You can find things that you need. The target is within 1 minute. You're organized enough to focus and find things to do when you want to. Being better organized would help you get more done, or clutter seriously impedes your time and task management. So why don't you select one of those, and we're going to stop polling in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and let's see what we've got. Move this over for us. Okay, so we get very few people who feel like they're on their best game with clutter. We have most people kind of in the bell curve, and we have quite a few people who are kind of not measuring up to the standards that they would like to. So clearly, this part of our segment would be something for you to pay attention to. Thanks so much for participating in that poll. Let's take a look at the physical effects of clutter. A cluttered workspace can lead to cognitive overload. What your brain is constantly looking for is safety. We have evolved to find safety wherever we are. So your eyes are constantly scanning your environment, and that is causing your brain to create algorithms of possibility and probability. So clutter can negatively impact your concentration. It obviously makes things harder to find. If you have a pile of stuff on your desk and you know something's in there, but you're cognitively paying attention to it, but you haven't located it, can make it hard to find things and handle documents inefficiently. This can be very true when it comes to case files, and it's even more exacerbated when we talk about digital clutter. You can lose things, waste time, hinders focus. It very much will slow down your ability to start, and certainly drives inefficiency and lateness. I remember I was called for jury duty once, and there was a poor disorganized attorney who came in, and things were falling out of his hands, and his bag was open with stuff falling out, and it was not a very professional. I kind of felt bad for the person he was representing, frankly. So let's take a look at why and how complex these executive functions are with regard to decision making. Remember that all of these areas, this image might look familiar to many of you who attended the other session, but all of these areas require your brain to inhibit certain things and focus on other things. So several brain areas are involved: your prefrontal cortex, your striatum, your basal ganglia, your cerebellum. All of these areas are involved in different types of algorithmic predictions. So they impact choosing, what you choose to focus your attention on, or your spotlight, your locus of control, what you choose to do. They impact what you decide to do, which helps with switching tasks, filtering distractions, picking out what is relevant. This is thought to be the deciding piece. The frontostriatal cortex is thought to be smaller with people with ADHD. Just interesting. Planning, which is that third piece, this is where you start to step out a path of what you need to do. And this requires you to choose something specific so that you can create a path of entry to start. It also includes this attentional network, the orange, front to back, back to front, how you consistently are able to persist. People who struggle with inattentive ADHD or forgetfulness or distraction tend to really struggle with this back to front to back to front to back check-in, this scanning that your brain is doing in terms of sticking to tasks. And then moving and thinking efficiently. Again, this is the purple area highlighted on this image. And this has to do with increased coordination and efficiency in movement, and also efficiency in thought processes. It is kind of that inhibiting the external thoughts that don't really matter, but it also is the thing that is kind of that internal timekeeper, like noticing that we're, 10 minutes or 15 minutes into our presentation and noticing how that impacts what you have to do next. So, interestingly, I mean, this particular area of, and this is the area where a lot of people have light bulb moments about, wow, if I have ADHD, all of these things are to an extent compromised. And the answer is yes. And this is why it's important if you are, a person with ADHD, it's important for you to think about a diagnosis and think about how this is impacting your daily living. Okay, so what does any of this have to do with clutter? Well, our thoughts have to do with our beliefs, and that has to do with how we act. And so clutter in your environment, physical clutter, and this is also digital clutter, but digital clutter is a little bit different. So let's just focus on physical clutter right now. I used to do a presentation for people when I was an organizer on why people keep things. It was for the communities of people who were trying to downsize or who had hoarding situations or disorders. So people keep things for various reasons. Obviously, the most common are that they perceive something to be important. I'm keeping this because it's important. Another really big reason for people to keep things is because they perceive a value. It's worth something either monetarily or sentimentally. There's some kind of value associated with an item. Some people keep things because they didn't know they could get rid of them, their fear. This is especially true with papers and documentations. But it also, with physical clutter, might be fear of being without it, fear of not having enough, fear of, needing it, or fear of my mother-in-law gave this to me and I don't want to hurt her feelings. So there also may be people might be keeping something because there's a follow-up trigger. For instance, I have something on my desk right now, which is a water filter for my countertop water filter, and I have to return it because I ordered the wrong one. So that's a it's I'm keeping it on my desk because it's a follow-up trigger, and I've printed out the paper to return it and everything else, but it's out because I want to make sure that I do that later on today. People also have clutter because something is incomplete. They put it in a place and they're like, oh, I've got to remember to do this and it's not done yet, or I'm waiting on someone else or whatever. Some people may keep things because there's some sentimental past with it. Some people may keep things because of unresolved anger or grief. Emotions can play a part if we really start to peel back the onion. And some people keep things because they've had success, awards on your wall or accreditations or, your college degrees and your all the things that we might be keeping them. So there are a lot of reasons why people keep things. But when it comes to physical clutter as it relates to work, I want to just talk about this particular follow-up trigger idea. So when we leave things out, often we're leaving things out because we have not created a system where we have actions and activities. We might leave things out because we have poor working memory, or we haven't created a follow-up process of how we do things, or maybe we don't have a task list or a future list. So I often say, if you're a person who has a lot of clutter, we need to look at your task management system and your trigger system. Is something missing? Are you leaving these out? You notice in that second image there where the woman is packing her bag. She's put things out so that she remembers to put them in her bag. And then the second reason, this is one I deal with a lot as a coach, and that is a British client of mine said, these are just undecisions. And I loved that word, so I'm stealing it from her. And it's an undecision. It's like, I haven't made this decision yet, so it's right here. There's no place for it to live when it hasn't been decided on. So this kind of reflects back to Barbara Hempel's famous quote, clutter is postponed decisions. But it also could be that you're leaving things out because you are waiting on someone else to follow up or waiting on something in your future horizon of time to do. So that being said, there are obviously some things to consider when it comes to what you must keep. And I'm probably preaching to the choir at this point. You're already here. But what you must keep is anything that is used for emergency and vital files. I'm sure, since most of you are tapping in from California, that all of you have a go bag and you have your vital files all backed up, given the emergency situations that have happened out there. So anything emergency or vital that must be needed to reestablish yourself, and so anything that is valuable should probably be kept and logged in some way so that you have a category of it and you have record of it. Anything that's sentimental or historical, and obviously anything that is legal that would establish your identity or ownership or legal proof. So those are things you must keep. And then everything else is kind of subjective up to what you want to keep. So one of the things that a lot of people ask is, well, how do I get rid of this? How do I sort through the decisions I have to make to let go of items? And so when I worked as an organizer, I would walk people through this decision tree. And what we had to really, really focus on was not the hypothetical, I might need this someday, or it might be useful someday. What we have to really think about, especially if you're in a clutter crash, a difficulty, you have to look at your work in your life today. Is this a behaviorally significant item to you today or in the near future? And then you want to ask yourself, do you love it? Do you love how it looks or makes you feel? Is it treasured? Is it beautiful? Does it make you happy? Do you need it to function? Do you have space? It's a big one. Do you have space for it? You know, humans just fill up the space we're given. So do you have space for it? Do you have an actual plan to use this, or do you just have a someday plan? And if there's a redundancy, can you get it elsewhere? Okay. Or if you're holding it for someone else, is it for that someone else now or soon? Or is it for someone else way down the road? For instance, people who kind of keep baby items and stuff like that, or toys and things that can tend to be very cluttery. Does keeping the item keep you in the past? This is another big question when you're dealing with letting go of items. Does it meet your current aesthetic? Like, this is very true with clothes. Do you love this thing? Do you love the way it looks on you? Is the color good for you? And then the final question that we always ask is, have you used it in the past year? Because a year is a pretty good amount of time. And if you haven't, but you think you might, then I always recommend putting it in a bag or a box and label the box, check in 6 months. And then if you haven't used it in 18 months, it's probably okay to let go of. So when it comes to clutter and executive functions, I'd like to ask if there are any questions at this point, because sometimes people really, this triggers a lot of conversation and thoughts for people. So I'm happy to take questions now if there are any.
No questions just yet. I do have a comment here from one of our viewers talking about still experiencing anxiety despite keeping neat and organized.
I'm missing context on that comment. I'm not sure how to handle that one. Is it clutter anxiety? Is it something else?
Maybe the person can ask another question for clarity and you can address it after the next session.
Perfect. Thank you, Belinda. Yep. Great. Okay. So I'm happy to answer those questions as we go. If you can be a little bit more specific, we'll come back to questions. Thank you. Okay. So now let's shift over to the digital clutter. And this is the one that seems to bog a lot of people down. So when we talk about digital clutter, we're talking about digital files. We're talking about email and notifications, however they come in from any different thing. And then we're also talking about establishing workflows that will help you increase your focus and decrease the noise. So these areas, attorneys who effectively manage digital files are typically less overwhelmed, manage their caseloads better and more effectively, more able to quickly access information and focus on current tasks without unnecessary disruptions. Email, we're going to take on email a little bit in the next couple of slides, but email tends to be unwieldy for a lot of people, so we'll look more at that, and then we'll also look to develop some workflows. And again, this is where I'd like you to check in with yourself and pick up one of these if they are of interest to you, or if they're one of those things that made you answer that being more organized would be helpful. Is your problem here? And if so, let's pay attention to the things that we may do to make a difference. So, digital clutter solutions. Obviously, coming up with managing your digital files is going to be critical. This can be really difficult for people to do, and you have to think about if you are sitting in a digital hell because you can't find things when you need them. This has to be approached like an intervention of some kind. Like you have to take time away from work to address whatever the system is to manage your digital files. The second piece is on email. Now, many people use email as a trigger to follow up tasks. And what I want you to consider is just redefining email from how it was intended. Email is simply just a pipeline. It's just like the little cups and the string that we used to play with when we were on the, you know, when we were kids on the playground. It is a conduit for information. So it is someone sending you something and you're receiving it. In order to effectively use email and lower your threshold of pain in email, you must create a paired system to process whatever comes from email that is important or that induces some type of follow-up or action. You must create a way to catch everything from email and take it into your doing machine, take it into your system. So, this is one of the critical areas that people don't do. They just use email as their task list, and that's what makes it so difficult because there's no memory trigger, there's no task management, there's no project management, there's no fi things get lost because it's simply a conduit of communicating. So the other thing you want to do with digital is to limit your notifications and instead batch how you address your email. So you may do it a couple of times a day. If you're on an incredibly intensive schedule or case, you may have to do that more frequently. But if you can stack or batch your follow-up tasks to work on them individually, it can really be helpful and it can really reduce the amount of anxiety that you have about email. I try to help people with creating a tolerance. Like similarly, you'll always have dirty dishes, you'll always have dirty laundry, right? It's always going to be a part of just living. But if you set a time to do the cleanup or do your laundry a couple of times a week, then somehow your mindset shifts about whether or not that undone thing is bothersome because you know, oh, I do laundry on Mondays and Thursdays. And so the dirty laundry can wait until the time that I've established a routine and a task. So think about email in this way for yourself. Do you need a structured approach to email? Do you need a way to process email and pull it into your task management system so that it is less of a slog? If you are struggling with email, choking with your email, you need to think about this as a project and come up with a reset plan. Create a backlog based on where you are today. Like just go through it and take what you need to create your backlog of activities. And then establish a streamlined workflow to help you reduce time wasted on navigating through. And simplify, simplify, simplify. I used to have, you know, I used to categorize emails and put them in subfolders and do all kinds of things. But as search has gotten more effective, I simply archive by the month now, and then I can go back and search if I need to. I delete a lot of things that I don't need, but I've simplified that process of having to sort it all out because it wasn't useful to me. Now, I'm not sure what it is for you, but creating your own process, maybe it is important for you to sort client files or certain things into certain subfolders. But it's important to think about how to simplify the processes and, again, do it so that you can find what you need when you need it. There are some experts out there who talk a lot about email, and I'm going to focus on the top four. One is the Getting Things Done system by David Allen. There's a couple different ways that he approaches it. He talks about the 2-minute rule, and that is if you get an email that's going to take you 2 minutes or less, do it now. Again, this is within the construct of you are working on your email and you're in a batched task association where you're working just on email. So the 2-minute rule. And he also talks about categorizing email to sort it out into just these three big buckets. Is it actionable? Is it reference? Or is it trash? And that's one of the ways that he streamlines his action in email. Cal Newport, and we're going to look at him a little bit later, but Cal Newport, who is the author of Deep Work, talks about batching email processing and reducing email conversations. If it's a back and forth, he really recommends reducing unnecessary conversations, either with better automation or with follow-up that is different. Otherwise, you can have hundreds of people coming in on an email, and it can be difficult to figure out what's going on. Merlin Mann, he's the guy who came up with Inbox Zero. This is he basically actively reduces your inbox clutter by responding, deleting, delegate, or deferring. Inbox Zero talks about coming up with automated filters and minimizing the number of emails that require manual action. And each one of these systems, and then Tiago Forte is a second brain. So he says that you should integrate email with your notes, things like Evernote or things like Notion, and you should label and archive so that you can find things when you need them for efficient retrieval. And I think overall, what you want to think about email is, am I going to need this in the future? And I know in the legal profession, you've got to re you, there's redundancy everywhere, so you have to be careful about getting rid of things. But somewhere in these systems will be a hybrid system that is appealing to you. And this is where you need to do the deep dive, because you need to come up with a way. If you're in, email purgatory, you need to come up with a way to process your backload. If you have 10,000 emails or 16,000 or 100,000 emails, one of the things that you might do is just simply archive for now and start fresh. It's an easy way to do it. And then go back to your archive, and set yourself a time limit of less than 2 hours a day that you're going to work on it. And just remember that 80-20 rule that, 80% of your focus is on 20% of what you probably get. You can automate your process by searching by sender, bulk delete anything that is not useful, archive anything older than 2 months, delete large attachments. And my favorite thing is unroll.me. This really manages my subscriptions, any shopping that I've done online, and everything else. It all rolls up into kind of a dashboard of unroll.me. And it saves me from looking at probably 150 emails a day that go into the Unroll Me. And I just get a dashboard report, and I look and see if there's anything useful to me there, and can pass it on. I don't, I can also unsubscribe, which is also helpful. But the Unroll.me, if you don't have that, or you don't haven't been familiar with it, you might want to check it out. It's really useful. If you want to folder and name and label your inbox, use your inbox only for new and unread emails, and then you can subset everything into action required. In other words, you need to respond to it, waiting, follow-up needed, reference, save for later, and delete immediately. So those are, again, what you'll notice in any of these systems is they really come up with a very broad category of what the next action is. And if this is appealing to you, this could be really helpful. Again, if you're in a place where you have a terrible relationship with your email, you want to get to a place where you can easily scan and delete junk morning, midday, and evening, clear up any pending items, and set your work for the next day. And then weekly, empty your trash. That's ideally where you want to get. But again, email is really, really a struggle for a lot of people. So this is something that has an immediate impact if you can decide how to work with your email and then help yourself be consistent. Okay, how about now before we move into the productivity piece? Anyone have questions or was there any more to attend to?
Someone's asking, where do I start? Kids coming in today or 2 weeks behind, 2 months ago?
Typically start today and then batch everything from before. And if you want to work on that as a process, but if you start today and say you want to start your folder and labeling system, you can start today and just batch things and create emails up until March 31st, 2025, and you can start today with a new system. You'll always have that backload. But I used to do scrapbooking as a craft, as a hobby, and I had thousands and thousands of pictures. This is before digital pictures, of course. And the advice was always to start just today because you're more excited about today. And if you're going to start a new system, you can start today to see how it works. You really are, what you're doing is you're establishing a new pattern and you're establishing a new behavior. So you can start today and archive everything in the past and see how it works. Anything else?
That's it. Thank you.
Great, thanks. All right, so let's move into the second part of our segment today, and that is productivity. Obviously, productivity is measured by the rate of output over the rate of input. And so, how productive you are has to do with what you produce. And with ADHD on board with productivity, distractions don't only diminish your productivity, but also can really distract from your overall job satisfaction. So, ADHD significantly impacts workplace productivity, and we're looking at the same statistics that we did first off there, in the stats above. So, thinking about where you lose your productivity, is it distraction? Is it executive function delay? All of these come to play, and I want to zoom out a little bit when we think about how to get productive, how to start. And this is a thing that I do often in coaching. We have to take these thoughts and intentions from the back of our brain and move things to the front of our brain so that we can focus our attention on them. So we go from intention, I really want to do this, to attention, what do I have to do? And then to action. And so this process of moving from intention to attention to action can be sluggish and it can be really compromised by too many things to do. So as we move into productivity and we look at energy management, let's start this motivation poll. Like I just can't get motivated. So let's take a look at these things for the poll. I'm consistently able to tap into energy to do work. My habits, systems, and workflows support me easily to start my work. I procrastinate, but when I have to do work, I can. Stress is a problem for me. I consistently struggle to get motivated to work due to many factors, and I feel I'm bordering on burnout, like, or I'm already there. So if you can pull that poll up, is it already up? Hello.
Hi there, just a moment.
Thank you. There it is. Thank you. So weigh in on how you're feeling about productivity. And we'll have 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and we'll see how we did on productivity. All right. So we have a lot more people focusing on or answering that stress is a problem and consistently struggle to get motivated. I think, this is not unusual. Stress is very, very, has been very, very high. And so motivation is obviously Stress for many people becomes not stress to act, but stress to quit. So let's look at motivation from a full brain concept. Factors that impact motivation: interest, novelty, fun, ease, capability, confidence, ownership, urgency, importance, relevance, winning conditions, what works for me, and emotions. And if you think about all the things that come to play with motivation, you have to think about them as, I mean, a good metaphor that I like to use is a web where you may have pressure in one of these that stops you or starts you. Motivation and ADHD are tricky. It's tricky to stay on top of everything that you need to do. And this is where it's useful to look at a metaphor or a model. When it comes to ADHD, all three of these areas, both awareness of yourself and what your conditions are, how you step into doing tasks and getting started, and then what you consider to be complete, are all often compromised or at least difficult if executive functioning is not coming to play. So we use this as kind of a 10,000 foot view of where are you? Where are you experiencing breakdowns and difficulties in your awareness of everything that you have to do? Are you overwhelmed? Is it the how to get started, the engagement process and staying attentive to? Or is it, I don't really know what this task is. And so because I can't define it, I can't get started. And so we're going to look at this as a view and as a not just a metaphor, but also a process by which you can look at your own motivation. So here's what we know. ADHD brains have trouble with lengthy, repetitive, boring, and routine stuff, and they really excel in the urgency, new, novel, interesting things. And if you want to learn and change your brain as an ADHD adult, there has to be a high level of focus and engagement. You have to get through the threshold of the doing. There's no way around it. You have to lean in and focus very hard to do work. From Huberman Lab, Andrew Huberman, who is a PhD, and he has a great podcast called Huberman Lab with a lot of neuroscience in it. But he notes that to attain significant brain rewiring, you have to teach your brain how to do things and induce a sense of urgency that leads to the release of norepinephrine, which is adrenaline. You have to have that urgency to release the adrenaline. That hormone will make you feel agitated, like you have to go do something. So at that point of agitation, you have to focus that agitation on increased focus and fight the urge to go out and do something else. So this eventually leads to acetylcholine, which is the neurotransmitter that helps your brain move forward and do different things. So again, when you look at motivation and you consider all of these things that come to play when you have ADHD, we're going to look at each one of these areas as it comes into play with productivity. So let's talk about motivation as a feeling. Waiting for motivation to do something is productivity suicide. Basically, science is telling you, science is fighting your own biology. Relying on motivation is flawed. According to a landmark study in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, 70 to 80% of our daily actions are driven by habit and environment, not willpower. And this explains why motivation-based productivity fails most people. It happens to all of us. So in order to get started, we are going to look at very ridiculously small steps to help you get there. But, using the excuse, I just wasn't motivated, so I didn't get it done. You will never be motivated to get things done that you don't want to do. So let's talk a little bit about stress. There are two different kinds of stress. There are external stressors and internal stressors. And external stress, an exhausting work schedule, trying to receive a promotion, a bad relationship, getting married, losing a parent or a spouse, buying a home, finishing a degree, finances, major life-changing events. Those are external stressors outside of you that impact your ability to focus. Internal stressors, worry, obsession, pessimism, mindset, irrational thinking, cognitive overload, negative self-talk, unrealistic expectations of yourself, perfectionism, inflexible boundaries. Those are internal stressors. And there's no pill, potion, silver bullet, magic formula, speech, podcast, or book that replaces your internal drive. So, extrinsic motivators can give you a temporary boost, but the lasting motivation comes from within. So, it's not about going to find that silver bullet or app or morning routine that's just going to be exactly what you need. It's actually about connecting your life and your work to what matters to you and then building it from the inside out. And awareness is key to this entire process. Okay, so let's talk now about this whole ADHD dopamine equation that everybody talks about. When it comes to staying motivated or getting motivated or doing work, remember that dopamine is a neuromodulator of pursuit. Like dopamine is delivered when we decide what we're going to do and we get after it. It's the little kitty that my little kitty that goes outside and looks for the chipmunks at this time of year. It's a complex hormone and neurotransmitter that affects your emotions, your behavior, your movement. It plays a major role in how you feel, whether you seek reward and stay motivated. And it is highly triggered by urgency, newness, novelness, and something that you find interesting. But it's not alone. It doesn't just work on its own. It works with norepinephrine, which is the brain's chemical of adrenaline and serotonin. And it's a process of, benefiting your brain in all of these areas. You can't just dopamine hunt, which is the newest thing out on TikTok now. You have to understand that it's a complex relationship, which is why we talk about externalizing so many things with the ADHD brain. So, you want to work with in concert with yourself and your life to help you build conditions and help you build conditions over time. Dopamine has evolved us to help us reward certain behaviors that keep us alive. And so it also builds memories and it agitates movements. That's what it's all about. But conditions matter. And if you are living your life constantly only in urgency, it's your key to burnout because you're amping up your dopamine levels and you probably are experiencing great fall offs after a task is completed. So we look at energy management, and that is a very personal thing. It's an understanding of these fluctuations that are throughout the day, throughout the week, throughout the month, that have peaks and valleys and help you focus. But it's important from that awareness standpoint to pay attention to your own energy levels. Task scheduling can really help you here because you want to optimize your performance based on your own personal energy format. You might be a morning person, so you might want to do your high activities in the morning. You may not rev up until 5 or 6 in the afternoon. And so you want to work on the things that really matter to you in the areas that coincide with your biorhythms. So implementing an energy management system or taking breaks or working out at a certain time of day can help you really body focus these energy levels and help you work on more productively. Because at the end of the day, you need to either take action or not based on what you can and cannot control. Stress is your ability to manage controlling your inner experience. And so this model is one I use often with clients. Are you taking action over things you can control, where you can move things forward, or are you taking actions over things you cannot control, where you're spinning your wheels? If you take no action over things you cannot control, you're letting go, which is a totally fine thing, letting go of things. And if you take no action over things you can control, you're giving up, which is another perfectly fine choice if that meets how you approach your decisions in your world. But ideally, to optimize your productivity, you want to take actions that help you and over things that you can control. Okay, so best practices for ADHD. Stop multitasking. Multitasking, research shows that multitasking is a significant impairment of performance. You must focus, your locus of control focuses on one thing at a time. And when you multitask and you stop and start, you exponentially hurt yourself. So you have to develop focus techniques, create scaffolding, repeatable processes, work on the internal pieces of spiritual mindfulness practices, manage your stress, and get help where you need it. Some stats on multitasking, and there are some references at the end of this presentation about all the statistical research. Productivity, the switch tasking incurs a mental cost. Productivity drops up to 40% due to interruptions and divided attention. Learning and memory are weaker, and a lot more errors occur. So I'm just going to skip over this next slide. And remember, again, it's what you do or not do that helps you with motivation. So this is going to be a personal exercise here as we're coming toward the latter part of this presentation. And this is a brain dump exercise that I ask clients to do. What's on your plate? We don't have time to do all this in our segment today with the webinar, but this is one of those ones that you can take outside of the webinar and talk to yourself about all the tasks that are on your mind, and then differentiate between whether those are goals or projects or tasks. And then you can create categories of them and put them in these areas. A lot of times we don't differentiate that last bullet there. We don't differentiate between what is a task, what is a project, and what is maintenance. And so it all lives in our working memory, which causes more and more stress. But if we can differentiate, we can help our brains do the thing that our brain does best to help us focus, and that is inhibit. So if you have a project like wallpaper in your bathroom, you know that's going to take a full day. But if you have a task like going to buy bananas, you might be able to more easily help your brain do the thing that we looked at in the last webinar, which is solve for how long is this going to take? What are the steps that I have to take first? And when will I be able to stop? What's the outcome? So take that example. If I need to go buy bananas, it's a pretty simple task, right? How long do I have to take? Well, however long it's going to take me to go out, go to the store, and come back and do it. And then the steps are easy to determine. If you have a huge list of things and you have not differentiated between tasks and projects, it's going to be very difficult for you to get motivated to take the action because there's too much cognitive dissonance in your list. And so think about your task list in this way. Are you focused on projects and tasks equally? Do you have a place to manage your projects? Do you have a system that you are using, like Asana or Mondays or ClickUp or anything like that, that helps you keep these big projects straight? Or are you just lumping everything together, making it harder on yourself? Another process that is a productivity cue here is allowing yourself time for deep work. And there's a book out by Cal Newport called Deep Work. And it's the ability for you to focus without distraction on cognitively demanding tasks. And we live in an era where deep work is getting harder and harder to do. Another quote, Neal Stephenson, if I organize my life with lots of long, consecutive, uninterrupted time chunks, I can write novels. But as those chunks get separated and fragmented, my productivity drops spectacularly. Steve Jobs, a quote, it's not about all the things, it's about the one thing. And then Andrew Huberman says deep work bouts should, of either mental or physical exertion, should be tapped out, optimized at about 90 minutes. So, how often are you giving yourself scheduled deep work time? Again, this might be a place for you to cherry pick a productivity strategy to try. Remember, in our last seminar, we talked about the brain modes and networks. And remember, in order to override default mode, which is always on all of our brains, and shift in that threshold to attentional mode, we have to be able to inhibit all of the information in autopilot, right? The task positive network is a different part of your brain, and it requires your focus. Learning is sometimes easier than the attentional mode where you have to intentionally trigger your awareness. The duration, path, and outcome formula can help you here, but also Huberman talks about intense focused learning to be 90 minutes. And then he recommends either a deep sleep or a non-sleep deep rest bout of 20 to 90 minutes to help enhance your neuroplasticity and optimal learning. So if you're working on learning something new, for instance, it's a study strategy more than anything else, but the idea here is to just think about your day in segments of 90-minute time periods when you have to do deep work. If you're doing transactional work, it's not the same. But if you have to do deep work where you're composing or doing a lot of research, you have to think about your brain's ability to take in information, but also assemble information. That's where the deep sleep or the naps or the breaks come to play. This has been true for a long time. Just minimizing interruptions and distractions. This is an old 1925 model of what was this thing called? The isolator. It was first introduced to help narrow the field of vision so that distractions were taken away. So again, if you need to do this in your work environment, you need to get better at managing your environment to eliminate interruptions and distractions. There are plenty of time tactics that people, oops, excuse me, plenty of time tactics that people use, countdowns, timers, a million different things. What makes it difficult is many people with ADHD struggle with appropriate estimating of time, but using timers is very, very helpful. And lots of different prioritization strategies have been talked about, but some of them you'll see here on the right column. You'll hear about the Eisenhower matrix or, urgency and importance. A lot of times people with ADHD have a hard time with that. Pareto principle, the 80-20, eat that frog, do the biggest thing. But what I like to do is with ADHD, start with easy so that you can build on your wins. So while you may have a giant project to do, it might be much better for you and your energy management to work on some of the smaller things that you know you can get done, and then it will set you forward to getting you moving. Decide in advance what you're going to do, and I say start with easy because when you build on task completion, it's easier for you to eliminate distractions and disruptions. Okay, before we move forward, I want to check in with the group and see if there are any questions or comments.
Currently, looks like we just got one. It's kind of related to your last presentation about boundaries, actually. Maybe she didn't watch it. So, for setting boundaries, do you also mean a need to set boundaries with ourselves?
Oh yes, I do. I mean that. I think boundaries are imperative. And especially a boundary helps you create safety. So setting it with yourself and setting yourself up for success will be helpful. I mean, I love this image. I actually took this picture at Hershey Park in Pennsylvania because it talks about why scaffolding in your environment and boundaries and structure is important. Because this is obviously an old school roller coaster made of wood. And this thing has been around probably for almost 100 years. I don't know how long, at least 50, let's say. But it is designed for one thing, and it's the speeding car, the mass and the volume of that speeding roller coaster to zip by. But that structure remains. That structure remains so that zippy car can go by and everyone remains safe. And if you think about creating scaffolding in your environment, and what that looks like for you. You may need it for yourself. Boundaries are included. You may need it for your behavior to stay motivated, for planning, for memory things. You need scaffolding in all these areas to be successful. What it might look like is reminders and accountability, having people check in or you check in with yourself, systems, routines, planning, procedures. The idea is to constantly slow down what your brain has to hold on to in order to make decisions. So anytime you can build things into your external environment, it will make work easier. Tracking and logging is another thing. Sometimes it might be helpful for you to do a time audit. Where are you spending your time? Where are you losing your time? One of the attorneys I was working with was getting in the office at 6 o'clock in the morning, but not really working until 9. And we had him track his time, and he was like, "Oh, well, I went online and I did some shopping," and he kind of had this really slow start thing, but he was tricking himself to say, "I'm gonna go in really early," but then didn't have any setup of what he was going to do when he got there. So scaffolding and time tracking can be super helpful for you to prepare any systems that you need to make work easier. Systems come to play with maintenance, with people management, documenting, communication. Again, the same type of thing that we looked at when we were looking at the email process and system. They may be helpful for you to put in your own workday and in play. Obviously, a system makes things easier because your brain can predict what to expect. So, automation tools can help you effectively eliminate repetitive tasks and manage administrative duties easier. Any kind of system can help you reduce manual tasks. And there's a ton of apps out there. I wanted to offer, I have Inflow is an ADHD app. They used to have a coaching group that I used to manage, but I have a referral link if you're interested in an ADHD app to help you. They have shared work environments, but you're welcome to use that referral link for a membership. There's also a free download of all the apps and a review for what they are intended for. I think, Susie, you have a link to this as well in the documents, but if you want to try different apps for your own person and for your own reasons. There are focus ones, self-care ones, goals, tasks, transitions. There's a ton out there. Apps are useful when they help you solve a problem you have. So it's really important for you to think about what problem you're solving before you go to an app. And we will distribute this link to you or this PDF to you. So to overcome time troubles, you need more clarity typically. You need more granular understanding of what things are that you're saying yes to, why you want to help, or what's in it for you. And then you need to think about the time cost so that you can check your budget and hold on to any unpredictables and then decide yes or no. There's a lot of decision making. Again, executive function is going to be pressed whenever you deal with where your tasks meet time. There's a lot of little tips in the rest of our presentation. I know we've run over the full hour here. So I just want to tell you what is here in terms of things to think about for yourself. Rules, rituals, and redundancies. Your brain is a prediction maker, not a storage system. And this is why we constantly come back to what are the areas that you can pattern? Where can you create redundancy in your world, in your work, so that you can make things easier. Patterns and associations help you simplify. Obviously, when a process is simpler, it's lower cognitive load. It helps you anticipate. Therefore, you can anticipate and stay motivated, and it helps you push through that activation threshold out of the default mode network and into the attentional mode network. So, patterns, pairing, salt and pepper, peanut butter and jelly, clean desk and concentration. Patterns help you with predictability and redundancy, and that's why we create things like rituals and habits so that you can optimize your environment, when you're going to do things, how you're going to do things, and support yourself to get started. If you are just approaching work with no patterns, you are making things so much more difficult on your ADHD brain, and it's worth your time to look inquisitively at your environment of where you can create patterns so that you can create new connections in your brain. Okay, routines and habits, it's beneficial helping yourself create these areas in your workflows, and how you approach work can be helpful, especially if you're working in a place of burnout. I like the term cadences, like pump, pump, like this idea that you have a startup or a sun up cadence, you have a sun down or startup and wind down. You want to create a structure around how you approach time daily and look at your time horizon, at your appointments, your priorities, blocking time. You read this all over in the productivity world, but the reason why is it makes it easier on your brain. Again, these are all personal strategies. So, all of these are simple ideas that you can look at and cherry pick what is useful to you. Movement is also a bottom-up approach to helping your brain work better. Remember the neuromodulators we looked at? Movement is involved in producing all of those. And what we know is serotonin is delivered based on big muscle movement. So, exercise and focus is a really important part of how you approach your day and managing your time, believe it or not. So is healthy eating and diet. These all matter in terms of how your body handles insulin and how your body pays attention and how you are able to manage your workload. It wouldn't be fair to not allow yourself recharging. Some people like to exercise, some people like to do other things, but these are all areas that might be helpful. There is the case of remote work. A lot of people are in hybrid work environments now. And so, one of the things that is really helpful for remote work is to set your workspace up remotely as if it's an office at work. One of the things that I like to think about, and as a metaphor for setting up remote work, is a dental hygienist. When you go in to get your teeth cleaned, all of the tools are set up, everything is in the same place, everything works. So you want to think about your remote work similarly, to set yourself up with supplies and make sure that when you work remotely, that you're chunking work and managing your environment in the same way. Remember in our last session, we talked a lot about how your environment predicts whether or not you're going to be successful. In an ADHD friendly environment, you want to remove or reduce sensory triggers and create a workspace that helps you feel like you have a structured day and a predictable day. So it could include your seating, your headset, personal timeouts, dead periods, anything that is predicted by you that helps you feel better and attentive should be a focus for addressing your productivity approach. There are obviously hurdles associated with any work with ADHD. With maintenance and admin, of course, the hurdles are deciding, it's boring, figuring out, remembering. And instead, this is like a before and after. If you struggle with people issues, and you face the ADHD hurdle there, you can instead work on the things on the right column. Email, you might struggle with writing or response on the right side. create templates, doing things under pressure, phone, you might struggle with the ADHD hurdle. And these are just simple, again, ideas. We're cherry picking a ton of ideas. So, a lot to cover today, and we wanted to come up with productivity strategies. I know it was a lot to throw at you. I'm hopeful that at least one or two of these ideas have been useful for you to think about in terms of your own productivity and your time. If you want to learn more about me, you can certainly find me online on LinkedIn or on my website at sanespaces.com. And I'm happy to address any additional questions before we wrap up.
Alrighty, we do have a couple here. Someone was mentioning, they're looking at this, they can see how it benefits, but at the same time, how do I do this and keep, let's see, it looks like another big thing to do, to get to do and just to start. How do they get that started or, trying to get that done without, stressing out about it?
It's again, I think how you do anything is how you do everything. If you have a lot of work to do, it's probably a great time to either join a group or work with a coach and then parse out where you're going to get your bigger wins easy, where they're going to show up. It's so much when we think about productivity, and so many things to consider. That we have to start where you are and where you're experiencing your biggest breakdowns. So, part of that is going to be an approach to auditing what's going wrong and where the pain is and where the pain points are, and then picking from those. I know with almost every coach, especially an ADHD coach, we start with a big basket of goals. Most people have 10 to 20 goals that they want to work on when they come into coaching, and then we prioritize them based on the pain. And yeah, that's kind of how we do it. You have to do it in your way.
Great, thank you. And then I have another one here. Most often in this case, Christine asks, you are recommending to finish small tasks first. What if the small tasks end up getting done and I'm pushing the bigger project out day by day? What's the general strategy here to buckle down on that big task?
Well, again, the startup strategy is small tasks to get started so that you have some wins and then you shift over into the bigger tasks. If you're using small tasks to procrastinate, which can be what people do, at some point you have to pre-decide of when your work bouts are going to be on the bigger tasks. Like you have to create that focus time, with the guy with the mask and the little eyes here. At some point, you have to create the time and the discomfort that you're going to shift into the bigger task. I know that research shows that there is an element of agitation and discomfort of up to 6 minutes before you start the big task. But using that duration, path, and outcome, and if you say that if you look at the big task and then you granularize it down to, what's the first thing I have to complete here? Very soon, if you choose that first thing to complete that outcome, you will start with the first three things. And that's the discomfort that a lot of people distract themselves from. Like, what is it that you really have to do? And if it's writing the brief or if it's contacting the client or whatever it is, you have to go from the big signal, the big ADHD scary signal, to that one task that has a very specific outcome, and then start that. I don't know if that's useful. It's hard to just do as a hypothetical, but
Thank you. And then I do have some questions here, last ones, mainly regarding anticipatory stress, how they define it. These two people talking about anticipatory stress and how do you manage that, I guess, before getting started with something and, crossing that hurdle?
so this is a really good question, because anticipatory stress is it's typically your working memory saying to you, don't forget, don't forget, you got to do this, you got to do this, you got to do this. It's actually a signal designed to get you to start. But ADHD slows that down from the thinking part of the brain, which does all the work, and there's a slowness between the doing, where neurotypical might think, oh, I've got to do this, I go do it, right? That threshold is the hard part. And so that anticipatory stress, remember, if we can rename it to a signal, like a starting signal, and then have that be, what is it? What do I have to get done? What do I have to start? And what are my first three steps? It can be useful.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. All right. So I would like to invite anybody else if they want to reach out, feel free to connect through LinkedIn, and you can see the references and research sightings at the end of the presentation charts that you guys get. But I want to thank you all for being here with us today. Sorry there was so much to cover today. I'm happy to take up this conversation anytime in the future if I can be helpful.
That's great, Sina. Thank you so much for your time today, and thank you so much to our audience for spending this morning with us.
Thank you.